Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome back to week two of Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. I'm going to invite us to open with a word of prayer. Jesus, our sovereign, you assure us that you are with us always to the end of the age. You tell us that whatever we do to the least of your kin, we do it to you. Teach us to see you and serve you in the poor. Help us to know you and believe in you through transforming relationships with those in need. We pray for the sake of your love. Amen. So last week, we opened our study with an introduction to Always With Us, this book by Liz Theo Harris. And just a reminder that you don't have to read ahead to keep up with the study, so if you haven't downloaded your notebook yet, you're still set. But if you decide you want to read along, you are very welcome to do that, and you'll get more out of it. In the introduction, Liz Theo Harris told us the story of a group of homeless families and their allies who broke the locks on a closed church building and moved in. They built community there, they cared for each other, and then when the church authorities demanded that they moved out, the families protested that because Jesus was a homeless person, evicting them was like evicting Jesus. And so that sort of theological point right there is going to shape today's chapter, which is ending poverty possible? Is ending poverty possible? Just trying to aim the recorder more or less toward everybody for when we have conversation later. Not to worry. So the title of the book comes from a biblical story, and I'm going to begin reading that biblical story, and this chapter is going to dig a little bit into this story. So this is on page 13. While Jesus was in Bethany, in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. "Why this waste?" they asked. "This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor." Aware of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." So Theo Harris is taking issue with a common interpretation of the particular phrase that Jesus spoke in this passage, "the poor you will always have with you." And she runs into this phrase in conversations with critics of the work that she does working with the poor, working specifically to end poverty. And this line, "the poor you will always have with you," is sort of thrown back at her as an argument that, well, poverty is inevitable. Jesus said so, right? And not only is it inevitable, it actually may be what God meant to have happen. So throughout this chapter, Theo Harris begins by talking about some of these. They've become kind of common sense understandings of this. Matthew 26:11 is the verse there for those of you who are chapter and verse people. these common sense understandings say, one, poverty is inevitable. It's just going to happen. The poor will always be with you. There's also a sort of a partner to that understanding that says that poverty is the fault of the poor. So poor people got themselves into this situation some way or another. And sort of as a result of this, the conclusion is that there's no meaningful response to poverty other than charity that manages the very worst effects of poverty. So people are going to be poor. Being poor is bad, right? It's almost like morally bad. But it's also, it's a bad thing, and we should, you know, we should help them. We, rich people, should help poor people so that they don't have to deal with the very worst effects of being poor. They shouldn't have to starve to death. We should give them food, for instance. But then Theo Harris goes on to point out that the Bible talks about poverty all the time. From the very beginning to the very end, one of the Bible's favorite topics is poverty and how we ought to respond. Specifically, the Bible talks about redistributing wealth and abolishing poverty. So over and over again, the Bible has this emphasis that poverty is something that, not that we should help people deal with, but that we should actually do away with as a people. So how does this verse, this line, the poor will always be with you, how does that fit with a Bible that is generally anti having poverty exist at all? So there's this popular opinion about the biblical view of poverty that says poverty just can't be ended. God doesn't even really want to end poverty. People deserve what they get. And good news for the poor, that's the gospel, right? Good news for the poor only comes in heaven, right? So there's this spiritual dimension, that's where good news happens, and here you kind of get what you get. Betty groans, that's not the only way that people think about poverty, right? So Theo Harris is kind of pushing against one particular approach to thinking about poverty. Sounds like Betty doesn't share it. I'm guessing not all the rest of us share that approach either. But bear with me here for a second. She does acknowledge that there are nice, enlightened ideas about poverty that say, no, poverty shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be there. People shouldn't suffer like that. But she points out that even these sort of enlightened approaches to poverty that say, yeah, we need to do something about this, there's still kind of a sense that we is rich people, and this is the situation that poor people are in. And there's not a sense always that the poor have agency of their own, that they themselves can do something to transform the structures that make for poverty. So she doesn't let even those of us who think that poverty can and should be ended, doesn't let us completely off the hook because she calls us to account for the ways that we often assume that ending poverty is something that people who are not poor have to do because people who are poor can't do anything about it or don't have the wherewithal as individuals or groups to do anything about it. Then she turns to academic treatments of this passage. So this scene happens right at the end of Jesus' teaching ministry, right at the beginning of the Passion narrative. This is something that happens in the midst of Holy Week as Matthew sets up his narrative. And this is the transition that changes from Jesus has been teaching. He talked about the end of time. He talked about all kinds of big cataclysmic events. Then this woman anoints him with fantastically expensive oil. The disciples get mad. Judas leaves and arranges to betray Jesus. And then Act 3 of the play unfolds from there. So academics spend a lot of time with this passage trying to figure out, okay, what exactly went on here? What is going on in this story? And Theo Harris suggests that these academic treatments use this passage, interpret this passage as saying that Jesus is more important than the poor, that he's actually setting up sort of a hierarchy, which you can hear if I read that whole verse, right? The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. So there's this sense that in this moment, it is more important to use this expensive oil to anoint Jesus, prepare him for his burial, than it would have been to care for the poor. So there's a hierarchy set up there. These academic treatments, she says, don't present any kind of real critique of the structures that make for wealth or poverty, although sometimes they do make an argument for giving to those in need. So there's still kind of this sense of, well, charity is good, but the structures that produce poverty just are what they are. Betty?
Well, yeah, but the people that were hearing that story then didn't know about the crucifixion and so on, so that could determine how they're interpreting things. Well, we're looking at it from after the fact.
Right, yeah, so we look at this story from after the crucifixion and the resurrection.
Right.
And those who experienced this story, the disciples, who are present in the midst of this story, they haven't experienced the crucifixion and the resurrection yet. They've had it talked about. Jesus is very explicit about the idea that he, as the Son of Man, has to be crucified and will rise again. But the Gospels are very plain with us as well that the disciples don't get it. They don't understand that. They don't even really understand it after it has happened, let alone before. So, yeah, the context in which Jesus is saying this within the story is different from the context that we hear it from outside the story. For what it's worth, though, Jesus has just, literally verses before this story, he has given that great big parable of the end of time, the sheep and the goats, and the goats go one way and the sheep go the other, and the difference is whether they recognized Jesus when he showed up for them. And the test of that is, whatever you did to the least of these, you did to me. So there is, I mean, there's more context around this, even for the disciples as participants in the story. For us, there's even more context about the crucifixion and the resurrection. So Theo Harris is trying to sort of bring us to the idea that poverty is a theological problem. Poverty is a theological problem, and that we have to deal with poverty as a theological thing, not just as sort of a situation that we encounter in the world around us, but actually as something that bears on our relationship with God. And so I'm going to read a little summary here, and then we'll dig just a little bit into this. These are, she says, theological obstacles to the idea that poverty can be ended. This is on page 26, if you'd like to read along. Given the ways that Matthew 26:11, that is, the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me, given the ways that Matthew 26:11 conditions popular and scholarly ideas about poverty, I have identified five main biblical obstacles from Matthew 26 specifically and from the New Testament in general that have been cited as arguments for naturalizing poverty and marginalizing the poor. I encourage others to examine, elaborate, and add to these assumptions as I explain them in brief here. 1, poverty was not an issue in Jesus' time. That's socio-historical. I'll skip some of those big words because it doesn't really matter. Poverty was not an issue in Jesus' time. That's one of the assumptions. The second assumption, Jesus believed in the inevitability of poverty, as he says right there in the text. 3, poverty is an individual problem and not a social problem. 4, poverty is the result of individual sin, not structural sin. I'll have to tease that word out a little bit for you. And 5, Jesus is concerned solely with spiritual poverty and other spiritual matters rather than material poverty and problems. So those last two especially are theological issues. So when Theoharis talks about naturalizing poverty and marginalizing the poor, naturalizing poverty, of course, is holding to the assumption that poverty is just a thing that's going to happen, right? It's like the rain and the wind, right? It's part of how the world works that poverty will happen. And marginalizing the poor is that practice of setting the poor sort of off to the side. They don't really have agency. They don't really kind of belong in with the rest of us. So these assumptions undergird that process of naturalizing poverty. It's always going to happen, and the poor are marginalized. They're not really completely one of us. And newsflash, the poor are most definitely of us. So whoever we are as a congregation, we are also a congregation of mixed wealth and income levels. So we are already in relationship with the poor. We may not even know it. So then Theoharis goes through and she deconstructs each one of these assumptions in turn. So she takes on poverty not being an obstacle in Jesus' day, and she talks about, we'll get into this more in depth later in the book, but she talks about the pervasive poverty that was all around Jesus throughout his ministry. There was a very small elite that controlled and benefited from everything, and there was a huge mass of very deeply impoverished people who were sort of captive to that system. She pulls apart this idea of Jesus believing in the inevitability of poverty. We're actually going to talk about where Jesus gets this phrase. We'll talk about that next week because he's actually quoting scripture there. And if you set that scripture back in its context, what he says comes out very, very differently. So hang out with me a little bit that Jesus does not believe poverty is inevitable, because we'll talk about Deuteronomy next week. That poverty is an individual problem, not a social problem, that it is the result of individual sin, not structural sin. I think I should probably pull apart this word structural sin just a little bit, because it's not a category that everybody's familiar with. It's probably not a category that everybody even buys. But here's what this category is like. We know what individual sin is, right? So God said not to do something, I did it anyway. God said to do something, I didn't do it anyway. In both of those cases, the I is singular, right? But particularly when you look at the commandments that God actually gives, very many of those commandments are given not to each of us as individuals, but are given to us as a group. So we as a people are supposed to treat each other in certain kinds of ways. And particularly, Theoharis calls our attention to the ways that we are called to treat the poor. So we are called as a society to make sure that the poor are not indebted to the point where they have to essentially sell their own freedom in order to continue to make ends meet, which that's not even a word that makes sense in the biblical witness. But that we as a society are meant to hold each other and hold the systems that our society lives by to account for the way that that treats those who are poorest and most vulnerable among us. We obviously have lots of rules in our own society that are rules given to and by us as a nation rather than each of us as individuals. So for instance, it doesn't make a difference whether I only drive 35 miles an hour down Ashworth Road if there's no actual rule about that, because the idea of speed limits is to keep us moving at more or less a uniform pace, and a pace that's safe for the conditions and the shape of the road. But that uniform pace is actually super important for traffic safety. So we have a rule that is set up so that we as a group will ensure the safety of those who are around us. And then you get down by, say, an elementary school, right? And then they turn on the flashing yellow light when the kids are there and crossing, because we, again, as a society, know that caring for children who are less able to A, be seen, and B, make good decisions around crossing streets, we as a society know that we have an extra responsibility to those kids, because we actually do understand the difference between individual sin or individual bad choices and structural sin and the structures that advantage some and disadvantage others. We could get way deeper into structural sin. You may need us to do that. But the overall a part of this overall argument is going to be that there were in Jesus' day and are now social structures that make it really hard to break out of poverty if you find yourself there, that make it really easy to find your way into poverty in certain kinds of circumstances, and that are sort of reinforced by parts of the way that society is structured, both governmentally, economically, in terms of the way that races and religions are privileged within society. So there's a lot there that I don't want to get too mired down in. But that's this sociological point that there are structures that cause this to happen, that this is not just a matter of people making bad choices. So your choices are set against a backdrop of these social structures. And that final assumption that Theo Harris needs to take apart is that idea that Jesus is concerned solely with spiritual poverty and other spiritual matters rather than material poverty and problems. So Jesus is all about spiritual things, not about material things. And this kind of comes down to a choice of how you're going to read the Bible. Are you going to read the Bible noticing the way that Jesus engages in a material world? Or are you going to read the Bible as if Jesus, everything he was doing was only focused on this spiritual world? And so you can actually test that pair of readings. And you could take the same story and ask yourself, okay, what does this story tell me if Jesus is only concerned about spiritual things? What does this story tell me if Jesus is also concerned about the material ways that we interact with the world and with each other? And which of those rings more true? Theo Harris is going to come down very solidly on the position that Jesus cares deeply about material things as well as spiritual things. So as we move along, sort of keep that particular assumption in mind, because it'll change whether this book makes sense to you. And in general, these assumptions that we bring to the Bible affect how we see the Bible addressing poverty and what we believe the Bible intends us to do about that. So that was a, this was a fairly in-depth chapter. There's a couple even more in-depth chapters to come, but just quick questions before we dive into some discussion. Questions about what I just said. Okay. So first discussion and reflection question for us. According to the count that Theo Harris cites, one out of every 10 verses in the Gospels has to do with poverty. One out of every 10 verses in the Gospels has to do with poverty. I didn't do that count. I'm citing the count that she cites. But that sounds about right to me. And the overall point of biblical teaching on poverty is that it should be eliminated, that it is not consistent with God's intentions for the world. So take those two points together. The Gospels talk a bunch about poverty, and the Bible as a whole teaches that poverty is to be eliminated. How does that compare to what you would otherwise assume is the Bible's view on poverty? How does that compare?
The number 1 in 10 surprised me.
The 1 in 10 is surprising. Seems high, seems low.
Seems high.
Okay, yeah.
That's not what I remember.
That's not how you remember it. Hello.
Well, glad you came.
So, does 1 in 10 or something like it, to whom does that ring true, and to whom does that feel like, wow, that's more than I thought? More than you thought? Did it like click with somebody? Like, yeah, of course Jesus talks that much about poverty. Nobody? Cool. Okay. Someone's assignment for next week is to read all 4 Gospels verse by verse and tally how many talk about poverty. Check her out on this.
I'll just go through a count.
You could just go, but you've got to read the verse to see if it talks about poverty. That's the thing.
That's true.
So, we don't necessarily assume that the Gospels are going to spend 10% of their time talking about poverty. How about that second assertion that the Bible testifies that God wants poverty to be ended? Does that ring true, or is that a little outside your sense of how the Bible speaks?
I think that rings true.
That rings true?
No, that'll never happen.
It'll never happen.
But Jesus told Martha that you'll always have poor people.
Right, so that's actually the source of the title of this book. This scene where Jesus is being anointed with really expensive oil, and the disciples protest, and Jesus says, well, the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. And next week, actually, we're going to turn to the verse from Deuteronomy that Jesus is quoting there and set it back in its context. So this question of is poverty inevitable is one of the core questions of this book. So you are exactly right that's sort of the crux of this issue. The book is arguing that yes, poverty could be ended, and it is God's intention that poverty be ended. Those two things are not even necessarily the same thing, right? Sometimes we experience God telling us things that, boy, it seems like we can't actually do that, right? When Jesus, for instance, takes the commandment not to commit adultery, and he expands that commandment to a commandment not to look lustfully at someone else, and we're all just like, well, then I'm sunk, right? So we are perhaps commanded to do something that's not possible. Part of the argument of the book is going to be that yes, this is in fact possible. It's a question of whether we are willing to do the work that it takes to do it. But keep us honest on that.
So I'm thinking you said this God wanted to get rid of poverty. My memory of this may be, my understanding may be completely imperfect, but it's something about the Jubilee year back in
Deuteronomy 15, as it happens.
And every 50 years or something like that, or 70 years, mm-hmm. all the wealth is, the land is supposed to be redistributed. I don't know if it ever happened. I don't know if they ever did that.
Right.
That's in there.
Right. So that is, I was wrong about what's next week and what's the week after. That's 2 weeks from now, we get the Jubilee year and Deuteronomy 15, which is the source of the verse that Jesus is quoting. But it also has this extensive description of how we are to, every 7 years we let the land lie fallow, every 49 years we cancel all debts, any land that has been sold is returned to the ownership of the family line that sold it, slaves are set free, and so the idea is that doing this would prevent some of these structural forces that make poverty become this permanent thing. So people may be poor from time to time, but they won't be sort of locked in. I think you're right to wonder, did that ever happen? At the same time, there it is. So how do we wrestle faithfully with that?
So in 10 years, I'm supposed to get my house back to the lady that sold it to us, even though she's dead?
Yeah, so let's talk about that in 2 weeks. Because I think the practicalities of this are going to be a real question for us, right? And what would have to change in order to make that process work? So yeah, keep that question, because that's a really real question in dealing with the how do we interpret that Jubilee commandment, and what do we do about poverty? I want to raise up these two assumptions these are both pretty common assumptions about poverty. One is the one we've just been touching on again, that it's this inevitable reality, right? Poverty will just happen. It's a part of a social structure. It's a part of how it's a consequence of, you know, just normal economics. It just happens somehow, right? There is also an assumption that poverty is the consequence of bad choices made by people who then become poor. Can we grant that both of those assumptions are, can I say, widely held when we have conversations about poverty? One, that it's a natural consequence of social and economic life. It's inevitable. It's always going to be there. And the other, that that it is the consequence of poor people making bad choices.
Well, there's a third choice.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that don't have jobs now that used to have jobs, and they're now poor. And it's not their fault.
Right. So there are those who have become poor through no fault of their own. I would say that's one of those economic forces, right? Is it possible to shape an economy in a way that everyone has jobs that pay enough that they are no longer poor?
No.
Okay.
The rich don't want to pay anymore.
So there are some.
The rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So there is the idea that this is an inevitable thing. And so partly you're offering one of the places where the one inevitable and the other assumption about poverty as a result of bad choices made by poor people, that they don't fit cleanly together, right? Because if there's a structural process where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, kind of no matter what they do, then poverty is not actually the fault of the poor.
There's a lot of people on welfare.
There's a lot of people on welfare.
And in order to get out of welfare, you've got to find a job. And that job usually does not pay for all the kids you have. So it's cheaper to live on welfare.
So it can be cheaper to live on welfare than off if you can't get a job that pays better than welfare. And what did I hear? Then what are you doing with the kids, right?
Right.
Right. So there we find choice by those who are poor.
But not everybody. Not everybody that's poor makes bad choices. But not everybody is poor. Not all poor people make bad choices. But there are poor people that do make bad choices.
So not all poor people are poor because they made bad choices. But sometimes that is the case, right?
Yes.
So sometimes it is the case that bad choices land someone in poverty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is some truth to the idea that bad choices can ruin your economic situation, right? And it is possible to make sufficiently bad choices or have sufficiently bad things happen to you, or both, right? It usually takes a combination of this, that would transfer someone from a very comfortable economic situation all the way down to poverty, right? So there is a layer of truth. There is some truth to the idea that poverty can be caused by bad choices on the part of those who find themselves in poverty. And there is a layer of truth to the idea that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, kind of regardless of the choices that poor people, or to an extent, even rich people make, right? This is now a few weeks old, but there was a brief kerfuffle on the news cycle and on social media when Jeff Bezos, who sent us our books, sort of lamented that he is now making money so fast that he has no way to get rid of it all.
Oh. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what a terrible problem, right? He makes like $273 million an hour. Like something, those numbers may be made up, they are. But there is, this is the rich getting richer, right? There is an amount of rich at beyond which point you can't get rid of the money fast enough, right? And there's something sort of that boggles the mind about this, but that's a piece of what I mean when I talk about these structural forces that create and perpetuate poverty. That when there's a certain concentration of wealth and power, it can be really hard to resist and push back against that. There is also an extent to which choices matter, right? And agency matters. And so if we ignore the agency that poor people have, we actually miss a really important piece of this equation. But if we imagine that everybody has complete agency and can do whatever they want relative to the economic world we find ourselves in, we also miss the point. So that's part of what we mean when we talk about these questions of, I'll call them, again, individual versus structural sin. And I'm using the word sin there because I suppose I buy the assumption that God does intend that poverty be ended. God intends that poverty not exist. And when God gives us images of heaven or paradise or the restored creation or the original intention for creation, over and over again, it appears that everyone has what they need and that that kind of deep impoverishment doesn't exist. So I'll just put myself out there as, yes, I buy that assumption, but I recognize all of the problems with it and all of the structures and situations that make it very hard to live into that intention. Next week, we actually get, if you have just gotten your book and you want to read, you should probably start now because this is the long chapter. And this is a chapter where Theo Harris actually describes a Bible study of this verse, of this passage, where Jesus is anointed and then says, "The poor you will always have with you." A Bible study of that passage with leaders of organizations that work with the poor. So this is reading the Bible with the poor. What does it? What do we see when we read the Bible not from a comfortable, wealthy standpoint, but with those who live at the bottom of the economic heap? And we will learn what we see from there next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.